You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. To get more in-depth analysis and commentary from our scholars, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast on iTunes, download on Stitcher, or find on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
I would like to welcome you to this forum on financial inclusion. And we are webcasting this event live, so we'd like to welcome our viewers from around the country as well as around the world. And for those of you wishing to post any comments during the forum, we have set up a Twitter hashtag at financial inclusion. So that's hashtag financial inclusion. Nearly 2 billion adults globally do not have access to bank accounts. This makes it difficult for them to access financial services, pay their bills, or transfer money to relatives. In addition, it's very hard for these individuals to be an entrepreneur because they are outside the formal financial system. It is also difficult for them to gain access to capital or to form a business when they do not have access to basic financial services. But the good news is that many nations have made commitments to expanding financial services for poor people. They understand that financial inclusion is vital to economic development and social inclusion. So they have developed financial inclusion policies and are implementing policy frameworks that encourage inclusion. Today, John Villasenor, Robin Lewis, and I are launching the second annual Brookings Scorecard, measuring progress on financial access and usage. With the financial support of the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, we have embarked on a 3-year study of inclusion in 26 developing nations. The short summary is that financial inclusion is taking off. We've seen progress in access to financial services in many countries. They're making efforts to help marginalized populations, such as women, minorities, refugees, and young people. And this is happening through mobile money as well as digital financial services. So this week, we have published our report and scorecard. Copies are available on the Brookings website. That's at brookings.edu/FDIP, F-D-I-P. So that will give you access to the full results. And then also, for those of you who are in our audience here today, we have a short version, a 4-page summary of the key findings, the scores of the various countries, and some of the key recommendations that we are making in order to help promote financial inclusion. So we encourage you to read our report. If you have any comments or suggestions on it, you can email that to us at fdipcomments@brookings.edu. That's fdipcomments@brookings.edu. So this is the second of what will be 3 annual reports. So we will incorporate feedback that we get and suggestions that you make into our next report. And we do appreciate all of the feedback that we got based on last year's report that we put out in August of 2015. We got a number of suggestions from people around the world in a number of different countries. We talked with leaders in the NGO community who are active in financial inclusion, and we're very grateful for all the suggestions that they made. So to give you a more detailed sense of the highlights of our study, my colleague John Villasenor will summarize the key findings. John is a non-resident senior fellow at Brookings, and he's a professor of electrical engineering, public policy, and management at UCLA. And he's written extensively on technology policy, financial inclusion, and the developing world. And then after John's presentation, we will hear from the ambassadors to the United States from Uganda and Rwanda, who will tell us what they are doing kind of on the front lines of trying to use technology to bring financial services to the people in their country. So I will turn the presentation over to John.
So I'd like to thank you to Darrell West, and thanks to all of you for taking time out of what I'm sure is a very busy set of schedules to spend a little bit of time with us here at the Brookings Institution as we talk about this latest study that we just released. I'm going to give about a 10-minute or so overview of the report and its key findings and put it in context. And then, as Darrell West mentioned, we'll then move to the panel discussion with the ambassadors. The objective of this, and just as an acronym reminder, FDIP stands for the Brookings Financial and Digital Inclusion Project. And the objective is to provide policymakers, representatives of the private sectors, non-governmental organizations, and the general public, information that can help improve access to financial services, financial inclusion, not only in the particular focus countries that we've looked at in detail in this study, but around the world in general. This is the second annual report, as Darrell mentioned. We launched this project about 2 years ago. So after working on it for 1 year, we published the first annual report in August of 2015. After the second year of work, we published this report that is being released today, and then we are now embarking, in fact, I've already started gathering data for what will be the third installment of the report to be published next summer. And what we do is we examine access to and usage of, so both the provision and the consumption of financial services in a formal context across a set of 26 economically, politically, and geographically diverse countries. One thing you might ask is, well, sort of why do it year after year? Why not just do it once? And there's a couple of reasons for doing that. One is what we're hoping, what we all want to see is change, is forward progress towards financial inclusion. And by taking annual snapshots, then we hope to be able to make not only evaluations of the situation as it is in that previous year, but also comparative statements about relative progress as time progresses. In addition, we, like anyone else looking at this field, we certainly have plenty that we can learn. And so based on feedback from people at many of your organizations and elsewhere, we've enhanced our scorecard metrics to what we hope will help us better capture the state of financial inclusion. So, for example, in this most recent year, culminating in this report today, we gave greater attention than we had in the past to the existence of consumer protection frameworks, as well as to the rate of adoption of smartphones, which we strongly believe are going to be very important in financial inclusion. In addition, we increased the number of countries in the study from 21 to 26. And in this year's report, we also highlighted some issues which are cross-cutting across many geographies, both within the jurisdictions that we've looked at as well as beyond. And those include access by women to financial services. The issue of gender equity and gender parity, obviously, is a global issue, not limited in any way to the particular countries in our study. And also, we've looked at some of the challenges facing refugees and under-resourced migrants, among other challenges they face. Obviously, they face a challenge in terms of accessing financial services. This is the list of 26 countries. Depending on how you look at it, this is either a big list or a small list. I mean, it's a big list if you're doing what we're doing, which is doing a very deep dive into each one of these countries and really trying to understand the financial landscape. On the other hand, you could argue it's a small list because there's nearly 200 countries in the world, and 26 is obviously a small subset. So you might ask, well, why not go for close to 200 countries? And the reason is that just as a matter of scale, it would be impractical for us to do the depth of analysis that we're doing in every single country in the world. And so rather than look at all the countries at an extremely superficial level, what we've chosen to do is look at what we hope is a representative subset of countries and look at each of those countries in a very detailed manner. And as you can tell by sort of doing a kind of an eye scan of the list here, this list includes countries that are very diverse geographically, politically, economically. So they are representative in many ways, not only obviously of their own financial situation, but of the financial inclusion situation you'd find in many other countries. And I'll also say that more generally, even though we have focused on the countries that you see here, financial inclusion is truly a global problem, and it is one that we have also here in the United States. There is a significant excluded population here in the United States. So by choosing this set of countries, we are in no way suggesting that the challenge is more acute here than in many other places. It is a global problem that affects every single country in the world. In terms of methodology, the ones in bold here are countries that we added in this year's study that were not present in last year's study. As I mentioned, we increased the number of countries from 21 to 26. In terms of methodologies, what we did is we looked at four, we can call them dimensions of financial inclusion, four kind of axes or different metrics. And then within each dimension, we examined a set of indicators that help illustrate the state of financial inclusion with respect to that dimension. And I'm breaking the rule here, don't show slides where people can't read what's on the slide, but just look at the left part of the slide. But the right part is there to illustrate sort of how we presented the information. And in the handouts you have, then you see it more clearly. But these are the four dimensions. Country commitment, how committed is the country's government to steps that can promote inclusive finance, mobile capacity, that is the capacity in terms of the infrastructure with respect to mobile communications, which is obviously it's a key factor in access via mobile devices, which is how more and more of the world is going to be accessing such services, the regulatory environment, and then finally adoption, and how much is actually, that's sort of an output, how much is it actually being used? And of course, these aren't completely orthogonal dimensions. You know, clearly, all else being equal, a country with a strong commitment to financial inclusion will generally have a more favorable regulatory environment. So we're not claiming these are, in a kind of mathematical sense, purely decorrelated. But collectively, they help provide a useful snapshot of the financial inclusion landscape in a particular country. And on the right, what you see is four colored columns, and maybe that may be all you see. But what I see is a list of countries, and what we've done is for each the four dimensions are listed at the top there in small print, and then you see the list of countries there. And for each country, we have then identified a score associated with the country. And I should also say as the caveat that we recognize that no scoring system is perfect. Anytime you try to quantitatively assess something like this, no matter what you do, you are exposed to reasonable criticisms that, you know, you should have done it this way instead of that way. So we are in no way claiming that this is the perfect way to quantify these things. We'd like to think it's a good way to do it and a useful way to do it and one that contributes to the dialogue, but we're always interested in and welcome suggestions to do it even better. What I'm going to do is briefly go over some of the how we actually calculate this. So when we're measuring country commitment, how do we do that? And so, for example, I'm not going to read word for word everything that's up here, but for example, with respect to country commitment, we have six indicators, and each one of these indicators is then evaluated with respect to the landscape in that particular country. And so, for example, whether there is a national financial inclusion strategy that has been published, whether that includes, or whether the country has quantifiable financial inclusion targets, next to last, existence of a dedicated financial inclusion body within the public sector, and so on. So there are metrics that we use to evaluate country commitment. Mobile capacity, we've looked at the six things listed here. Market penetration, 3G mobile coverage by population, smartphone adoption, availability of bill payments via mobile money services, and so on. So those are the things that we've looked at for mobile capacity. For regulatory environment, we've looked at the availability of agent banking. We've looked at the availability of mobile network operator-led mobile financial service deployments, e-money regulations, account access and usage, and so on. And then last but not least, on the adoption side, we've got a set of indicators which is more than what you see on the screen here, but I just put several representative ones on the screen. So, for example, looking at formal account institution account penetration among lower-income adults, percentage of adults utilizing online bill payments, frequency of account usage, that's another important indicator because, as everyone in this room knows, if you simply create an account and it sits there dormant, then arguably that hasn't done nearly as much to advance inclusion as if you create an account and it actually gets used. And collectively, there are, across these four dimensions, 30 of these indicators that you see listed here. So if you do the math, 26 countries, 30 indicators, you have well over 600, you've got a matrix with well over 600 entries, and you're assigning a a number in each one of those 600 and something boxes. So it's quite a lot of effort. And then at the end of that process, you can then tally everything up and end up with a total. I'll briefly go over some of the key findings. In terms of country commitment, the countries that received a top score include Colombia, India, Pakistan, Peru, the Philippines, and Uganda, which is of course represented here. And so there's some. So those are all countries where there was just a very strong demonstrated move towards country commitment. In terms of mobile capacities, what's interesting is some of the top scoring countries in terms of mobile money adoption, which include Kenya, Uganda, Tanzania, and Rwanda, were not among the top scoring countries with respect to mobile capacity. So that means that even these countries are already doing terrific in terms of mobile money adoption. It means there's a kind of low-hanging fruit, an easy opportunity to do even better by just broadening the mobile infrastructure. So there's sort of good progress on top of already good progress opportunities that are present in those countries. The regulatory environment, the countries receiving the strongest possible score were Peru, the Philippines, and Rwanda. There's been some really good progress, which I believe the ambassador from Rwanda will be speaking about in a few minutes, so I won't do a spoiler on that one. And then in terms of adoption for financial services, among our new countries, the Dominican Republic received the highest adoption score. And then in terms of, we added in an indicator measuring actual usage of formal accounts, and the top scoring countries were all in Latin America and in sub-Saharan Africa. In terms of calls to action, the report identifies quite a bit of detail about this. I'll just briefly go over some of them now. One is to establish specific measurable financial inclusion targets. One of the challenges that we have is among our 26 focus countries, and probably more broadly as well, there's a significant percentage, it's less than half, but still a significant percentage that haven't developed publicly available financial inclusion targets. Another important kind of aspect of that is that very few countries globally have established financial inclusion goals specifically focused on marginalized groups such as women. And this matters obviously because to the extent that quantifiable goals can be established, then that provides a yardstick or a goal towards which the country can then move. Point number two is to collect and analyze data relevant to financial access and usage. And this is not news. I mean, this for years people have been saying this is important, and great progress has been made. But there's still an opportunity to get more data. We see a lack of data related to things like frequency of account usage, not the existence of the account, but the actual frequency of the account usage. Data regarding, for example, trust in formal financial institutions, which is highly variable as you go from different countries, and then also demographic data gaps. We see, for example, I've mentioned gender parity issues, and we see a strong need for data to even measure what the lack of parity might be. And without that data, it's of course then hard to know where the progress is or isn't, and how to measure progress. And then we also think it's very important, number three, to advance enabling regulatory changes. There's a list of regulatory steps which are known to be good for financial inclusion. So for example, leveling the playing field for providers, ensuring an adequate consumer protection environment for consumers, adopting tiered know your customer requirements to make it possible for people across the economic spectrum to have access to formal services and so on. And then last but not least, the fourth call to action we've identified here is enhancing financial capability and just basically in growing the challenge is that growing access to financial services so that people actually have the ability and the knowledge and the access to these formal financial services. And also promoting ways, promoting the use of these financial services in ways that advance financial health. Clearly, if you provide credit services, but then they are not used in a way that advances financial health, then you arguably haven't really moved forward. So it's important that the capability to use these services in an appropriate manner is enhanced as well. So that's a summary of where we are. At this point, I'd like to invite the ambassadors to come to the stage, and I will provide an introduction, and then we'll go into some discussions and questions. Okay, so I'm going to provide a very brief introduction of each of our honored guests here, and then each of them will speak for about 5 minutes, and then I have a series of questions I'll be asking, and then we'll open it up to questions from the audience. So immediately to my left is Ambassador Waneja, who is the ambassador of the Republic of Uganda to the United States, and she has been in this position since summer of 2013, if I've got that right. Prior to that, she was a member of the parliament in Uganda for 10 years, during which time she was the founder of the Savings and Credit Cooperative Society. She earned a Bachelor of Science with honors from Kampala's Makerere University, and also holds a postgraduate diploma in education from that same institution. And then to her left, we have Ambassador Mukantabana, who is the ambassador of the Republic of Rwanda to the United States, as well as the non-resident ambassador to Mexico, Brazil, and Argentina. Prior to her appointment as the ambassador, she was a tenured professor of history at Consumnes River College in Sacramento from 1994 to 2013. She is co-founder and president of Friends of Rwanda Association, a nonprofit relief association created in the wake of the 1994 genocide in Rwanda. She holds a bachelor's degree in history and geography from the University of Burundi, as well as a master's degree in social work from California State University in Sacramento, California. So I'd like to ask, start by asking Ambassador Mukantabana to speak for a few minutes regarding some of the key highlights regarding financial inclusion in Rwanda.
Thank you so much, Dr. Drasano. Good morning. I needed to start by saying that financial inclusion in Rwanda is part of a big picture. In 2000, Rwanda set up a program, a development program known as Vision 2020. And that was to achieve middle income by 2020. And under that, an economic development for poverty reduction strategy aiming to implement the Vision 2020 was put in place. So it addressed many aspects, including financial sector reform process in the country. So therefore, the Rwandan financial sector development was launched in 2006 with the vision to develop a stable and sound financial sector that is sufficiently deep and broad, capable of efficiently mobilizing and allocating resources to address the development of the economy. So I needed to start by that. Under that vision, Rwanda and the leadership set up an infrastructure, and especially targeting technology on how we can prepare the people to take advantage of the financial sector. One of those was to put a fiber optic all over the country. 90% of our country is fit with the capacity to get this mobile economy we are talking about. And at this point, Rwanda now has 4G. So investment in technology is the primary and prerequisite to be able to achieve what we have set up to do. That the second part was to increase access to financial institutions and increase uptake and usage of financial services for everybody. And this took also some changes in governance. So good governance are also the prerequisites to achieve what we are talking about. In 2000, Rwanda decentralized the country. It means that all the sectors and economic sectors were going to be able to reach all the people in the villages and so on and so forth. We focused on the development of a stronger and more effective banking system. And the, for instance, one of the biggest change in 2011 was the change in the National Bank of Rwanda, where they enable instant and reliable time-critical banking transactions. So people, like, for instance, teachers, students, civil servants, workers, are able to make payments, pay bills, borrow money, save and invest through their commercial banking. So that was done through the central bank. One of the biggest developments in the country is what is known as the Umurenge Savings and Credit Cooperatives for the people. It's called the SACCO. It's in the sector, it's in the villages, which is a grassroots saving mobilization system that was launched in 2009 with the resolution to reach out to areas that were not served by traditional banks. So we have what they call SACCO. At this particular point, we have more than 500 throughout the country where people can get access to finance, to microfinance, and be able to start their own small business. One of the thing, because of that, the bank account deposit have increased by 10% just within a few years. One of the results of financial inclusion has been that about 89% of adults are financially included. These are people who are able to use the bank, including both formal and informal financial products. About 5.2 million people, individuals, are included for a population of 12 million people. So it's almost half of the population are included within that banking system. About 68% of adults in Rwanda have and use formal financial services. Debit cards drive the growth of bank usage, loan from bank, and high uptake of mobile banking. About 65% of adults use other non-banking systems. And those are the other parallel type of mechanism where you can get loans, where you can pay by using mobile money, and so on and so forth. Excluded are about 11% people. So the people who are still excluded from this kind of use of the any kind of financing included the poorest people, especially with women overrepresented, and we'll talk about women maybe an issue of banking and what the government has been doing about it, but also private sector. But young people, once again, thinking that the Rwandan population, about 70% are below 30, it means that most of our youth are young, and some of them are removed from the financial sector altogether. But it's one other aspect that we are following in the country. So to conclude, I can say that it's something that we are pursuing, and we are including more and more people. We are building more infrastructure, especially with the development of what we call secondary cities that are going to declog the capital city of Kigali, that has most of all the financial sector. It's going to include even more people as we move in the next couple of years. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Makantavana. Very much, much appreciate it. And so now we'll ask Ambassador Oneja some context and key highlights regarding Uganda and financial inclusion.
Thank you very much. In Uganda, the introduction of digital financial inclusion was such a welcome phenomenon, because the formal institutions are just so intimidating that, let's say, the women, they will hardly go to the bank. Here in America, when I go to a bank, as soon as I step through the door, I'm welcome. And at the end of my transactions, I am asked whether I am happy. In Uganda, it's not exactly the same. First of all, the structure alone is very intimidating. And for the women, it's even worse. For the rural communities, it's even more worse if there's such English. Anyway, in Uganda, the coming in of mobile money, that possibility, is so fundamental. As early as the late 90s, we had policy, regulatory, and legal frameworks that promoted competition and universal access to communication services. That was so crucial in this financial digital inclusion. The liberalization and private sector investment have been continuously and extensively promoted by government, so much so that government has a regulatory body known as Uganda Communications Commission to regulate the industry. We have a strong and independent, it's not only strong, but is independent, and that factor gives confidence to those who are operating within the system. We have established in the country a Rural Communications Development Fund to support those efforts to enable the rural people to access mobile money. The technological developments that have led to reduction in the cost of handsets, this has meant more and more people accessing handsets. These handsets, they are those that are cheap enough. They even have local names. Ka meaning small, so you have Ka Torch. Like this small phone, it even has a torch on it, which is an incentive for you to buy it. There is Ka Tourist, you know, like tourists will use it for 2-3 days and leave it for you also to use. In the country, we have a rapid spread of ownership of mobile phones. So even in village centers, you may be able to buy a cheap phone. So the mobile phones are quite abundant within the country. And this in as far as rural and urban peoples are concerned. It means, whereas not everybody in the urban center has a mobile phone, but compared to the rural people, you have more people in urban centers having mobile phone, but also in the rural place, you'll have people accessing a mobile phone. Now, of course, we have challenges. You saw from the presentation earlier how we are ranking as a country. In terms of country commitment, 100%, was it a percentage? Yes, 100%. Mobile capacity, regulatory environment, adoption. In as far as inclusivity is concerned, our country has put in place legal, regulatory frameworks to enable women specifically to not only participate, to contribute and to be there and to benefit from whatever is going on. We even have a fully fledged ministry for gender, labor, and social development to ensure that whatever legislation, whatever policies are put in place by government, different genders can benefit. You know, how are they benefiting? That is the purpose of the ministry. So, but we remain with challenges. When it comes to gender, truly there is big gender gap. The women who are rural versus those who are urban. We have literacy. There are fewer women who are literate compared to the men, but government has, we have universal primary education, for example, universal secondary education. Hopefully the women then will be more literate and be able to use these technologies. Of course, women have time poverty. The access to the mobile phones, to the handsets, is not the same for the men and the women. The men are more likely to access the phones than the women. The distances, those who are in the rural areas, are less likely to access the phones. And then, of course, we have got cultural norms as far as women are concerned. In a situation, let's say in a rural setting, who is more likely to own a phone, a man or a woman? It will be a man who will own a phone. So, and maybe even for the woman to own a phone, she may have to ask for permission from the husband. Then in Uganda, of course, we have the issue of taxation, which is also a challenge. It poses a challenge. There's a time when government has imposed a 10% tax on all money withdrawals, mobile money withdrawals, and that affects a lot of people. Then lack of interoperability. This is your word, interoperability.
But
I find it in your
pretty good.
Yes, so networks are not cooperating with each other. So in Uganda, we have got MTN, we have Airtel, you have Warid. So sometimes if somebody has an account with Warid and then Warid network is not working in that particular area, you cannot withdraw the money using MTN. So this this is a challenge. But all in all, I think we are on the right path in as far as financial and digital inclusion is concerned, because we have this regulatory and policy frameworks in place broadly. So everybody has to see how to benefit within those frameworks.
Thank you very much to both of you. So I'll ask a follow-up question to the ambassador from Rwanda. As a reminder for the audience, again, there were four dimensions that we looked at to assess financial inclusion: country commitment, mobile capacity, regulatory environment, and adoption. And Rwanda was one of three countries out of the set of 26 to get a perfect score on regulatory environment. So I would ask if the ambassador from Rwanda could perhaps give us a highlight or give a little perspective on that.
Yes, thank you so much. Rwanda developed a very appropriate policy, legal, and framework for non-banking systems. I can give you an example. If you go to Kigali, for instance, and you want to exchange your money for dollars, for Rwandan money out of dollars, you don't need to go to a bank. You have agents who are regulated through the banking system and who are able to provide the service. And this is all over the country. So you don't need to go to a specific bank to do what you're doing. So, and because of that, people are able to really use the money. The money can circulate throughout the country. as we have been improving, especially on agriculture, because one of the sectors that we are developing to become more modernized is the agriculture sector, because the majority of the people in Rwanda work in agriculture. It has helped them to be able to move the money around and to sell their products, because you have those agencies and agents who are doing that, but who are regulated within that particular framework. One example I can again give to you is this Murenge, what they call Murenge Sako. The Sako is a saving and credit cooperatives. And this has been throughout the country. So people are able to get access, to get mini loans, and they are insured. And especially now, since you are able to get a collateral because of the titling to the land. Every land in Rwanda has a title. This has helped women throughout the country because now they can inherit because of the registration that was passed by the Constitution in 2000. So all these kind of agencies came together to be able to enable people to use the money within, and also to be more democratic in how they are assigning and they are able to allow credit and so on. Yeah.
Thank you very much. So I would like to then ask regarding a perfect score on one of the dimensions. For Uganda, Uganda was one of six countries to get a perfect score on country commitment to promoting financial inclusion. So I was wondering if Ambassador Waneha can give us some perspectives on how that occurred and some highlights.
Well, first of all, right from the 90s, we have paid attention to the regulatory framework. We have, like in 1996, in 2006, 2013, and as late as January this year, we had the amendment to the Financial Institutions Act. And I think that speaks volumes that government is not just committed, but it will ensure that we have the regulatory framework within which everybody is included. I think that is strong in itself.
Okay. Are there, and this is for either ambassador or both, are there any takeaways from your particular country's experience that might be particularly relevant to other countries that are looking to make progress in financial inclusion? Sort of lessons learned, advice that you give, have based on, you know, the excellent landscape that you are creating in your countries?
For me, sorry. Go ahead.
Okay, speaking for women, speaking for people with disability, speaking for the vulnerable persons, it's extremely important that countries actually make it possible for everybody to be included in terms of legal frameworks, mechanisms that are put there. And in Uganda, this is done right from the Constitution. The Constitution provides for non-discrimination against women, whether by culture or whatever, religion, ethnicity, all these. So I think the legal framework is extremely important. Following that, you must have the right policies that do address these vulnerable groups. And women remain vulnerable, people with disability, the migrants, the refugees, you know, so that would be my take.
Thank you very much. And Ambassador Mukantabana?
I think she's touched on some of the same, but for us, it's number one, good leadership is important and good governance. Those are the, you know, lack of corruption, all these things are important. But also to have a very specific pro-poor delivery system, especially for the majority of the people, to promote local development. And for Rwanda to be able to do that, and what we can account for our development has been the development of programs that we might call homegrown programs, the ones that people can use fully, understanding how to use them, and they fit within that regulatory type of stuff. So banking, saving, and investment, insurance, debt, and so on and so forth, are embraced by the people because they fall within the traditional norm on how they are able to use their resources. And then the last one maybe is inclusive development, and that has to be the goal, inclusive development, and looking at all the demographics and how we can adjust the gaps, especially there.
Thank you very much. So in terms of there's obviously multiple factors that contribute to an inclusive environment, but some of them include, as mentioned, high-level leadership, good leadership, public-private sector engagement and collaboration, and a thriving digital ecosystem. These are all things that are important. Of those, do you see in your countries ones of those three that are particularly important in the context of your country, or are they all equally important, or where do you see any highlights you'd like to highlight about with respect to leadership, private-public sector collaboration, the digital ecosystem in your countries?
For me, I'd say the knowledge-based economy. So education is really the key to every single part of what we do. And I'm not talking about university education. For instance, now Rwanda is focusing greatly on investing in what they call TVET. TVET is a technical vocational education that is going to democratize education in rural areas for people to be skilled in whatever they are doing, whether it's agriculture, whether it's raising, whatever you are talking about. So education is the key. We've also been able to transform our challenges into opportunities. We are a landlocked economy, meaning that investing in technology is the key. Technology is big. So we are trying to get all our people connected, whether they are in the remotest village, and to be able to do that. So to do that, we have to build infrastructure. So we have been investing in infrastructure, technological infrastructure, but also, as I mentioned before, even creating small cities that can be a pathway to development for most of the people who are unable to link to the rest of the world, in terms of what you're saying.
All those that you mentioned must move together. You ignore one, you're unlikely to include everybody in the finances.
Okay. And then before we move to audience questions, one final question from me is, how do you see the future of financial inclusion in your country? Progress has been obviously as really great, and I assume you're optimistic about the future, but if you can give us some color on what that means, that would be of interest.
Yeah, I think it's not done. We all have got work to do. The commitment from the leadership is very, very important. In Uganda, right now, we didn't have a national ID. Right now, the processes are on. Not everybody has a national ID as yet, but I think that is just one of those steps to show that we are on it. We're working on it. We're not perfect, but the commitment is there from government, and I think the population is also waking up to these opportunities. As she said, my country too, 70% of our population is young, is below 30. And that's a big challenge. So education, good governance, all these things, continuous development of infrastructure, let it be roads, let it be technologically, whatever. The fight is still on.
Great. And Ambassador Mukantabana, any thoughts on the future of financial inclusion in Rwanda?
I would say this is a dynamic and which will keep evolving, really, to more convenient and to become more convenient and efficient as we move forward. And I can even see the difference, for instance, of what was last year. When people were still debating and were resisting the use of mobile money, because we really don't know anything that you can't touch and you can't see is very difficult to do it. But it's quite, when you get to Rwanda and you pay your bill by the phone, whether it's your power, you know, whether it's your money for the phone, and people are becoming caught up in that kind of cycle, and they like it, and it's very convenient for the people. And as I said, the biggest users are people in the agricultural sector. And our agriculture is being modernized not to become just an economy of subsistence, but economy of commerce, you know, something that you can expand. Meaning that people are finding it more efficient, but also better for them to just use the mobile money than going and counting the bills when you are selling, you know, 50 bags of potatoes. So it becomes in practice, and people get used to it. So what I'm saying is that we see that in the next couple of years, this will be more like something, a practice, than something we have to push for. So I see it very positively.
Great. Well yeah. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So we'll move to audience questions, and we have a microphone. The one thing I'll say, when you ask a question, it would be appreciated if you could just state your name and your affiliation, and of course, ask a question. And so please raise your hand, and I'll sort of, we'll sort of, maybe we'll start with the gentleman in the, we'll get you and then you, and we'll get to, everyone who has their hands raised, we'll get to it and more.
Yes, my name's Eric Larson. I'm an analyst at the U.S. Government Accountability Office. I don't know anything about the banking system in Uganda, but it kind of took me aback that the banks would charge, apparently, a 10% fee to withdraw money that they had. The banks here pay maybe 0.5% or 1% interest. My guess is from what you described, the Ugandan banks don't pay any interest. And it sounds like negative interest if they're charging 10% for a withdrawal from the account, if I understood your comment correctly. It would seem people would not want to put their money in banks under those conditions.
I can answer. It's not the banks. It was Uganda Revenue Authority that imposed a tax of 10% on mobile money withdrawals. Yeah, so it is still a contested issue at home.
So just to clarify, so it's not in the traditional bank,
no.
If you would have a withdrawal, there would be no tax, but then if you tried to withdraw, mm-hmm. So that's...
Yeah. But talking about percent, about borrowing money from our banks, the interest rate goes up to 30%. Yeah, it does. Yeah, yeah.
Okay, thank you. I think the gentleman back here had his hand up, and we'll get to everybody else who has their hand up as well.
Hi, my name is Adam Boymore. I was a journalist, now I'm a student here. I interviewed Mohamed Yunus about a month ago, and he said he was exceptionally scathing about the capacity of bricks and mortar, highly capitalized retail banks to ever really do anything to improve financial inclusion. Do you think that's too pessimistic? And if so, if you think that's roughly accurate, do you think that'll ever really change?
So the question was, if I understood that, it's a question for me. Okay.
Yeah.
I respectfully believe that's a little pessimistic. I think, that places like Latin America, you've had tremendous progress with traditional bricks and mortar banks extending their reach through agent banking. It doesn't mean they're actually building more bricks and mortar in every tiny little village in these countries, but the reach of these banks has been extended greatly through some very, very successful initiatives with respect to agent banking. And so I think inclusion is not an either or thing. I don't think you need to say, okay, everyone's got to move to mobile money and nobody should use the traditional banks. I think that would be a big mistake, as it would also be a mistake to say everyone should use the traditional banks and nobody should use mobile money. Mm-hmm. I think what you want to do is offer solutions that give choice and also solutions that are appropriate to the local context. And traditional banks in some jurisdictions have done a very good job of extending their reach. In other jurisdictions, for complex reasons, it actually turns out to be easier to extend reach using the mobile networks and the mobile systems. And in places like that, with the right regulatory and leadership environment, mobile money has taken off. So the short answer is my personal view would be that would be overly pessimistic, though of course there might be some who differ. I don't know if any of the ambassadors wish to.
No.
So somebody's, perhaps the gentleman in the front here. And then we'll go you and then. Oh, I'm sorry. So we'll get after her then. You.
Thank you very much. A short question for John and then I think a short question for the two ambassadors. Most of the African countries appear to be historically English as opposed to Francophone. And I wondered if there was a reason for how that filtered into your selection of countries. And then for the ambassadors, I'm curious about how people pay for mobile phones in your countries because and whether or not how they pay. I mean, here there are zillions of minutes, packages, blah, 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 and you pay through a credit card or through a bank. So I'm wondering how the way you pay for mobile affects its accessibility.
Okay, so on the Francophone issue, well, Haiti is not in Africa, but do I get a little credit for Haiti? Yeah, but no, there was certainly no intent to choose countries that were had a more of an English-speaking heritage than a Francophone heritage. That's a statistical accident, not anything that reflects any hostility towards those countries. We would have been just as happy to do it the other way around, but no intent there. And the ambassadors to the.
And then pays for mobile phones or buys them, gets them, how you think that affects the accessibility given how much this is dependent on access to mobile phones?
In Rwanda, you can do it two ways. The first, you have people actually who are employed selling those cards. You go and you put the units, you can buy a card for 5,000 francs, you can buy one for 500, you can buy one for any money you have. And you just enter it in your mobile phone and then you can talk. Or you can directly send an SMS and you buy it through the servers, like MTN or Tigo. You know, you have all those phone companies that can send you the minutes and then you pay. So it has been accessible. I can tell you that in my experience, at least all the villages I know, and I think he mentioned that I was the head of a non-profit agency. We worked in a village. Most people have cell phones. The challenges sometimes are power, you know, because you have to connect them and you have to charge them. So sometimes you'll find people going to the, you know, to the service in a government agency to plug your phone and to get it. But the more they've been expanding, because one of the priorities also is to be able to give power to the rest of the country. So it's one of the journeys we are also working on, using solar energy, but also off-grid or on-grid type of thing. Yeah.
I think, did I understand, is it buying a phone or buying the airtime to use?
They're just, at least here, there are different methodologies for how you pay for your mobile phone.
Well,
you know,
here.
You pay for minutes, you pay for it for a year. Yeah. And I'm just wondering how it works, how it plays out, and whether or not that impacts the degree to which people have phones.
In Uganda, when you go to towns, you'll find the mobile phone shops. You know, they're just selling them.
Yeah.
You can walk in with your cash and you buy. We don't yet have the system of credit cards. We don't have it as yet.
Mm.
So it is cash. You have your money. You buy the phone that you can afford. They're just available. Of course, people in the rural areas they don't have the chance to buy these phones as easily as those in town because they are not there. You know, you have these economic settings are different. They are poorer. The access is not so good. and they are far. The towns are far from the rural areas, so you have to pay. You have transport, and you're lucky if you have a good road, and if you have a good car, and you have all these issues. But otherwise, you just walk in and buy your mobile phone.
I think, yeah.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I mean, I learned a lot reading the 2015 publications, and I do hope to read 2016 as well. But based on the presentation you have given here, I have a couple of quick questions, right? I mean, you have done this on four parameters, right? To my mind, I think the end result should be the higher adoption. So I looked at the scores on country commitment, mobile capacity, and regulatory environment, and added them up and see whether higher score on that necessarily translate to higher adoption. I don't see that here. For example, Philippines has a score of 294, probably one of the highest score, but they have probably a lower score of 42 in adoption. So are we missing something here in terms of analysis? Are we missing something here? That's my first question. The second question is, you have looked at mobile capacity, as one of the key, aspects in this. But is that the only thing we should look at? Should we not be looking at other access points as well, which will determine the adoption?
Right. Well, I'll quickly respond. I'll go in reverse order. Mobile capacity we did indeed look at because it is an important indicator. And I'll emphasize not only for mobile money, but even if you're going to be accessing what you might call a traditional financial system, that access is going to much more in the future than in the past, everywhere, including here in the United States, be through mobile platforms. So mobile capacity is an important metric, but for the exact reason of your question, it wasn't the only thing we measured. We measured adoption with measuring mobile capacity. We also look at adoption. So it's that's why we have a constellation of things. Stepping back to your first question, are we missing something? I think the answer is a couple of things. First of all, some of these dimensions are, you could argue, sort of leading indicators, right? In other words, to the extent that you have an enabling regulatory environment and a committed country, you would expect that that would lead at some point in time to greater adoption of these services. We didn't only want to measure the kind of inputs because it's also important to look at how people are actually using these things. I would argue that that you've pointed out there's a lack of correlation in some cases, but I would argue that that's, in fact, means it's a good thing in the sense that if they were 100% correlated, if adoption merely mirrored what you could already find out by looking at the other metrics, it wouldn't really be adding anything to measure it. So the fact that we are measuring adoption and that is giving us other information not directly inferable from the other three dimensions is, in some sense, meaning we're covering another dimension of this multidimensional space. So I would argue that it is additive to the information that we're creating when we measure it. And the fact of correlation or not is itself interesting. So I don't know who's next back. I think the woman in the gray has had her hand up for a while. And then we'll go to, and if when she's done, you could pass the microphone to the woman in back of you, that would be appreciated.
My name is Judy Cochran with SIL International. Thank you for sharing with us this morning. My question for the ambassadors has to do with adoption. You both had mentioned rural communities, and you even mentioned the vulnerable. So my question is, to what extent is language a barrier to usage, particularly with regard to indigenous people and migrants, and any comments you have to addressing that barrier?
Language.
The language in my country, we have three languages that are official languages. And in any setting, we use the three languages. Rwanda was Francophone before it became, now we use English as well, but also Kinyarwanda. The majority of Rwandan people speak Kinyarwanda, all of them, pretty much, unless you were born in a foreign country and came back. But the majority speak that. English is well spoken. Now they've integrated the two languages, French and English, at the primary level, meaning that communication has never been a big problem, even in rural areas, because I talked briefly about decentralization. Decentralization meaning that we have a national government, but all the way to the village level, where people are pretty, you have all the government, even on village level. You have the executive, you have a mayor, if it's a little bit of a larger entity, meaning that people are self-contained, they are from the same area. They create or they translate difficult, you know, concepts in the local language. So you find out that kind, and that dialogue also goes all the way to the national government. Every year, for instance, one example I can give you, that has been one of the engine of development for rural Rwanda has been what they use. It's like a social contract. It's called the Imihigo, where each village was given the resources to develop what they have as resources in that particular field. And then at the end, they sign a contract of what they wanted to achieve every single year. And at the end, we have what they call a national dialogue. And it means that each part of the country is going to be able to show what they've been able to do with the particular contract they have signed. And the leader of that particular area has to account for progress or lack of it, or why the resources that were not there to be able to achieve that. So it's almost like a friendly competition. You see the region that is lagging behind, and then they have to explain why it's happening. So that has been achieved because of really the people ownership of their own development. So it could, I don't think it could have been rich if we were doing it from national government alone. It has been rich because of local, homegrown initiatives, traditional ways to reach development, you know, collective work, cooperatives, and so on and so forth.
Well, in Uganda, language can be a barrier, especially in the rural settings, because English, if you're going to have a mobile phone, most likely you have to say some word or two in English, and English you must have gone to school. Learn it. But we also have Kiswahili. And I think in my presentation, I also mentioned literacy as a challenge. So to a certain extent, yes, you should be able to pick or say a few English words and also Kiswahili words. English is a national language. It is taught in school, throughout school. So universal primary education, universal secondary education is fundamental. So language can be limiting, especially in the rural areas.
Thank you very much. The microphone was joined.
Thank you. Sandra Baer with Personal Cities. Given that financial literacy and financial inclusion are actually now newly recognized in some ways as a critical element of a smart city, I'm curious about how, when you talked about engaging the entire community, could you talk a little bit more about how, and John, this is also for you, I think, how you engage the private sector and beyond the phone companies and some of the technology companies, the financial firms. I mean, there's a whole lot of expertise within a community, within an area that I think needs to be brought in. There's stakeholders. Mm-hmm. But what exactly are you doing? How is that happening in your experience?
Pretty much we are focusing a lot in encouraging private, private sector. And the biggest part about facilitating them has been, for instance, to extend credit, to be able to extend microfinance in the rural areas where people can begin things, including, for instance, I can give you an example. There's a part of history that I don't necessarily want to go back to, but when we were trying to rebuild a nation that was completely devastated by genocide, there was no infrastructure standing after 1994. So rebuilding was pretty much like putting one stone over the other. But all the socioeconomic initiatives that we engaged in initially, whether it was from private sector, whether it was from government, was to achieve that kind of economic leverage and to restore hope and to do whatever, but also as part of reconciliation process. So if, for instance, I give you an example, what I was mentioning when we were talking about homegrown initiatives, I give you an example that you might know, like what do they call peace baskets? The peace baskets that are sold now at Macy's. We got a contract, an extra contract for 10 years to sell those baskets at Macy's. But it started as a way to enable the women who were widows, who were head of families, to be able to weave. It's a beautiful, very, and then we had some interest of people who wanted to enhance their productive capacity, but at the same time, it brought women together. The women who were widows because their husbands were killed, but also the women whose husbands have killed. So that brought people together. So when we talk about reconciliation in Rwanda, it's also part of the whole socioeconomic initiatives. You have a variety of many economic programs that are driven by private sector, but that have also been able to bring people together, you know, in many different areas. One second one I can give as an example, because it maybe can resonate, is like one cow per family. You know it as Haifa International, but we adopted it because Rwanda is the cow has a central place in terms of reconciliation, in terms of friendship, in terms of whatever you do. So what they call one cow per family, they call it Girinka in Rwanda. It means that a poor family is given a cow with an eye towards paying it forward. So once you get your own, you give it to your neighbor. And even if you didn't talk before, because of the symbolism of the cow, it brings the people together slowly but surely. So we have many, I can count, then community work that is now like a mainstay in Rwanda, that is our brand, what they call Muganda. This is what brings people together from the top to the bottom. I don't like to call people bottom, but I'm saying all the sectors, from the president to the person in the remotest village, when you build your country. Rwanda is known as the cleanest country because of the people doing it themselves. It's not an imposition. But once you have the ownership of your country, you do this and that, then you really develop it thinking that this is for me, for my family, not for somebody else. So we have that coming from private, but also sometimes the governmental sector. But we try. Initially, it was value added because when the people form cooperatives, it's because also they are bringing a semblance of families. You know, before traditionally, people worked in families, in farms. You had like 20 people working on your farm, if you go to where I came from. But because of dying or people leaving the country, you ended up being by yourself. So building cooperatives or bringing back another surrogate type of family, but for economic development. So we have all those kind of homegrown type of initiatives that have been pushing the people throughout the country to do that. But those are private sectors. It's not government-driven. Yeah. And then there are some that are, for instance, supported by USAID and other agencies outside of of Rwanda, that have been also helping the people to form those kind of economic-led type of initiatives.
Thank you. Any thoughts from Ambassador Wanecha?
Well, in Uganda, ours is a private sector-led economy. So having private sector engagement, well, there's no two ways about it. And we have this strong regulatory body, Uganda Communications Commission, that works closely with the Ministry of Finance, works with other government agencies to ensure that there is fair play and private sector is truly engaged. So it is a policy. And for Uganda, we still have a long way to go. We recognize that. But we are working hard, and any support, every support that we can get is most welcome.
And I'll respond not in the context of Rwanda or Uganda, but more generally. Of course, I think it would be fair to say that financial inclusion will not be sustainable unless there is sustained and continued engagement from the private sector. And for that to happen, the private sector needs to view it as a profitable enterprise. It can't be, in the long term, it can't be a money-losing enterprise. So we want the private sector, I would think it would be, a key ingredient for a continued private sector engagement will be that they see some of these services as good business opportunities. Yet, at the same time, there's a balance. We don't want these services to be exploitative, right? Because obviously that would then undermine the very goals that we're trying to advance here. So for this all to work, there has to be this middle ground where the private sector is engaged and wants to be engaged because they see these as good business opportunities, but also at the same time where there's this balance where that the people who are receiving the services are free from exploitation at the hands of these private sector providers. Mm. So there's a question here. Maybe the gentleman in pink and then the woman in the orange, if that's...
All right.
Hi, I'm Tomasz Trabuć from Solski Personal Master from Poland. I just wanted to ask about the internet access, because we are talking about the use of smartphones, but without internet, this would be not very useful, right?
I was going to say, it's just in general, I mean, it is... There's enormous progress in coverage. That's not saying anything that anyone doesn't know here. And while there are always going to be, or at least for many years, there's going to be some pockets of some countries that are not accessible, not covered by 3G networks, I think you'll see those pockets becoming smaller and smaller. And of course, our ambassadors here could comment on that. The other thing to point out is that there are an enormous number of financially excluded people living in these enormous urban centers throughout the world. Mm-hmm. And all of those urban centers are covered by extremely good networks. They're living under this incredible coverage. So there's just in terms of pure numbers, there's just an enormous set of people for whom coverage is not the challenge. There's many other challenges, but coverage as well. And I'll let the ambassador speak to specifics.
Precisely. What you just answered is the same. It's what's happening at home. You know, internet access is not a given in some areas because the infrastructure is not so well developed in those areas. But most of the urban centers, they are well covered with internet access. And it is an ongoing development in as far as the technology is concerned, of which I'm not an expert. I will not go into backbone something.
I have to say that internet is also, for Rwanda at least, I can say the internet is very much, they are trying to develop it as a tool for education. We have a program called a laptop per child that has been expanded also in rural areas. So it's something that they have started even actually to put together, you know, the computer in Rwanda, meaning that they want to give everyone who has the capacity to connect some computer, or at least to put them in centers where people can go and have access. So it's something that we are using also as a backbone to education, because we believe that internet capacity comes with this kind of popularization of education and democratization of education.
And just to add to that, you know, these things change faster than all of us, you know, expect. A few years ago, I started writing about what I thought was smartphones as a key vehicle, and some people said to me, "Well, that's ridiculous. You know, some of these people aren't going to be able to afford smartphones." But of course, the price of the basic entry level smartphones has plummeted, and now they are within reach to an enormous set of the population. You're seeing this incredible global shift towards smartphones, which over the next couple of years is going to continue to occur. One stunning statistic I read not too long ago was that in China, there's over 1 million smartphones sold every day, every single day, just flowing into the economy. And so we are quickly moving to a world where nearly everyone will be able to afford mobile internet access in the sense of being able to afford a smartphone of some kind or another, and an increasingly greater fraction of the world population is going to live in areas that are covered by networks that are capable of delivering internet. Not always. You'll always be able to find some places which are still off the sort of the coverage grid, but those places are becoming smaller, and I think without in any way minimizing the challenges that remain in those places, it's still something to celebrate when we have huge swaths of the global population having wireless access to the digital economy. I think it's a good thing. I think the woman in orange was next.
Hi there, I'm Rita Veer. I'm a grad student in business and public policy. I wanted to ask about your views on credit assessment. So I know both in Uganda and Rwanda, there are really interesting things happening using technology to get information on telecommunications, social media, and that's enabled a different way to view credit scores. So just wondering your views on that, how that's enabled more financial service adoption and access to credit.
And you?
Not about you, Uganda. I can't speak in great detail about credit assessment in Rwanda or Uganda. But I can tell you that credit assessment is an area in the fintech world of amazing innovation. There's a lot of people using machine learning algorithms to do online credit assessment in ways that weren't possible before. For example, one area I am familiar with in that specific context is Mexico, where there's some really interesting startup company activity where these companies are using machine learning to do very quick credit assessments in ways that are novel and using. It's possible to use information that goes beyond the traditional information that you might have thought would be used for credit assessment in a place like the United States. So I think there's, again, this is a private sector-led opportunity. Private companies realize that there are people for whom who deserve credit, but for whom the traditional measures of credit may not indicate that. And by using more sophisticated big data, machine learning-based algorithms, there's a lot of innovative ways to deliver that. So I think there's a lot of change happening there. We have time for maybe a couple of more questions. I think this gentleman here had his hand up, and then we'll get over here. So why don't we can get this gentleman. You're up.
Hi, Steve Marcus with CARE. I've had the good fortune of visiting Rwanda a little over a year ago. Beautiful country, and I got to see some village savings programs that CARE is leading there. And I hope in the coming year to visit Uganda. A quick question for both of the ambassadors. What role do you see non-governmental organizations like CARE and others playing in financial inclusion?
Thank you so much, and I'm sure you enjoyed my country. One of the, we welcome any partnership that is helping wherever we want to get. But at the same time, what maybe I can put an emphasis upon is that it has to be within the context of Rwanda. So it means that whatever international organization comes, it has to adapt to the realities of the area. It means you work within the perspective of the development of the region. But we have had incredible positive but also very successful partnerships from the non-governmental agencies coming from here, going to Rwanda. And even that particular one I was telling you about, the peace baskets and so on, they've been promoted by organizations from here. So it's that kind of partnership where it becomes serve Rwanda, but also the Rwandans are learning from it and are working side by that, so with the agency. So that would say in general, we really welcome all the positive partnerships. Whatever you can bring as value added, we welcome. It's wonderful, and we are here also to facilitate whenever there's anyone who is interested in going and exploring any avenue to work with our government. The last one, maybe I was going to respond quickly about how I think she was talking about credit. Just one thing that maybe it might not answer your question, but what I know is most people who are starting a business, especially in rural area, don't have any collaterals. But what has served is the use of those cooperatives because people are going to vouch for one individual. So it means that you have an entity that is going to back you up when you are a part of that cooperative. The second one is also the use of land, especially for women. In 2000, the new constitution allowed women to own land. It means that now they can inherit land, and land is one of the biggest commodities where you can actually get credit by using your land, even if it's not developed. So that has allowed the people in the villages to get credit, to get the money in my country. Yeah.
For the gentleman from CARE, CARE does a lot of work with communities, and needs of communities are as diverse. It's just up to you to choose to include financial and digital inclusion in your programs, because people will always need either the education and how to manage their money. Are they just going to be accessing it? But how will they use that inclusiveness for their own good? So CARE, you work with communities, at least as far as I know. So there's plenty of work there. Yeah.
Maybe one final quick question. Maybe the gentleman with the tie right there.
Hi, thank you. My name is Anis Tinani. I'm with the Inter-American Dialogue. And I had a question in regards to mobile capabilities. In regards to international remittances, what is the potential for people to transfer funds across borders through mobile money devices? And what challenges do you foresee in the future in both Uganda and Rwanda and internationally more broadly? Thank you.
I think for most Ugandans here, those who have become American and those who are like me, we are sending money all the time. As soon as I get my paycheck, I have to see whom I have to send $10 and $50. So it's there. It's happening all the time. Here there is Wave something. There is Western Union. There is MoneyGram. There is, and these are very, very active in our countries. So
I think it's the same. I don't know the transferability without using those established channels, like the ones that she mentioned, Western Union or bank to bank.
Yeah.
But what I can tell you is the development in the region, because as we started to form a stronger East African community with Uganda, Kenya, and Tanzania, and so on and so forth, what we have found is also that, for instance, the roaming fees are being removed, something that didn't happen, meaning that as we talk about even that the transferability is also being developed within the East African community. We have started already some processes where we can actually exchange, whether it's the money, whether, you know, I can give you an example before to bring something from the port of Mombasa to Rwanda, because we are landlocked. It would take like 22 days or more. Now, because of the opening of the borders and those kind of protocols we've signed, it takes just 5 days. And it means that there's a lack of corruption on the way. You have to pay on one port, even the taxes have been removed. So for people who are trying to invest in our countries, I think that presents an amazing opportunity, because there are taxes that have been removed as part of the whole East African community. You can start a business in Rwanda. It's the hub. Or you start it in Uganda, but it's going to expand in all the region. So it's not just that small entity we are talking about.
And I'll just say from our broader study, we've seen just in the last 2 years since we started the study, we've seen specific to mobile money services an increase in the number of those services that are specifically permitting, with the regulatory blessing of the associated governments, specifically permitting cross-border transfers, but there's still progress to be made. So in the interest of staying on time, let me just say a few very quick closing remarks. First of all, very appreciative of particular Ambassador Mukantabana and Waneka for taking time out of what I'm sure are incredibly busy schedules to speak with us, and thank you for all of you. I'll mention again that, of course, the report is available on the Brookings website. And one other thing to say is we've talked a lot, or at least I talked quite a bit about sort of these scoring metrics and things like that, but one of the things we'd like to think of is a very valuable part of the report, in addition to that, is for each of these 26 countries, we have a very detailed description of the financial landscape in that country. So if you want to know what's going on with financial inclusion in Turkey or Haiti or Mexico or Chile or any of these other countries, we'd like to think that, you know, you can sit down and read the description there, and that will give you a good snapshot. And we're endeavoring to make sure those are updated and capture all the developments in each one of those countries. So again, thanks to all of you for your time, and particularly to our ambassador guests.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.